Your audience also determines how you start your message. If you are speaking to the unchurched and you spend the first part of the message on the historical background of the text, by the time you get to the personal application, you will have already lost them. When speaking to the unchurched, you need to begin where your sermons normally end up. Jesus related truth to life. I love the practicality and simplicity of Jesus' teaching. It was clear, relevant, and applicable. He aimed for application because his goal was to transform people, not merely inform them. Consider the Sermon on the Mount, the greatest sermon ever preached. Jesus began the Sermon on the Mount by sharing 8 secrets of genuine happiness. Then he talked about living an exemplary lifestyle, controlling anger, restoring relationships, and avoiding adultery and divorce. Next, he spoke of keeping promises and returning good for evil. After that, he moved on to other practical life issues like how to give with the right attitude, how to pray, how to store up treasure in heaven, and how to overcome worry. He wrapped up his message by telling us to not judge others, to be persistent when asking God to meet our needs, and to be wary of false teachers. He then concluded with a simple story that emphasized the importance of acting on what he had taught. This is the kind of preaching we need in churches today, preaching that not only attracts crowds, it changes lives. It is not enough for us to simply proclaim that Christ is the answer. We must show the unchurched how Christ is the answer. Sermons that exhort people to change without sharing the practical steps of how to do it end up just producing more guilt and frustration. A lot of preaching is what I call "ain't it awful" preaching. It just complains about our society and makes judgments about people in general. It is long on diagnosis and short on remedy. This kind of preaching may make Christians feel superior to those out there, but it rarely changes anything. Instead of lighting a candle, it just curses the darkness. When I go to a doctor, I don't want to just hear what's wrong with me. I want him or her to give me some specific steps to getting better. What people need today are fewer ought-to sermons and more how-to sermons. Some pastors criticize life application preaching as shallow, simplistic, and inferior. To them, the only real preaching is didactic, doctrinal preaching. This attitude implies that Paul was more profound than Jesus, that Romans is deeper material than the Sermon on the Mount or the parables. I call that heresy. The deepest kind of teaching is that which makes a difference in people's day-to-day lives. As D.L. Moody once said, "The Bible was not given to increase our knowledge, but to change our lives." Our goal is Christ-like character. Jesus said, "I have come that you might have life," John 10:10. He didn't say, "I've come that you might have religion." Christianity is a life, not a religion. And Jesus was a life application preacher. When he finished his teaching to the crowd, he always wanted them to go and do likewise. Christ-like preaching is life-related and produces a changed lifestyle. It doesn't just inform, it transforms. It changes people because the word is applied to where people actually live. Sermons that teach people how to live will never lack an audience. Please understand, the unchurched are not asking that we change the message or even dilute it, only that we show its relevance. Their big question is, so what? They want to know what difference our message makes. I've found that the unchurched in America are very interested in Bible doctrine when it is applied in practical and relevant ways to their lives. For me, it is challenging and enjoyable to teach theology to the unchurched without telling them it is theology and without using theological terms. I've preached sermon series to the crowd on the incarnation, justification, and sanctification without ever using the terms. I've also preached sermon series to the unchurched crowd on the work of the Holy Spirit, the moral attributes of God, stewardship, and even the 7 deadly sins. It is a myth that you must compromise the message to draw a crowd. Jesus certainly didn't. You don't have to transform the message of the Bible, but you do have to translate it into terms the unchurched will understand. Jesus spoke to the crowd with an interesting style. The crowd loved to listen to Jesus. Mark 12:37 says, The large crowd listened to Jesus with pleasure. The New International Version says they listened with delight. Do people delight in your messages? Some pastors actually think they have failed in their preaching if people enjoy a message. I've heard pastors proudly say, "We're not here to entertain." Obviously, they're doing a good job at it. A Gallup poll a few years ago stated that, according to the unchurched, the church is the most boring place to be. If you look up the word entertain in a dictionary, you'll find this definition: capturing and holding the attention for an extended period of time. I don't know any preacher who doesn't want to do that. We should not be afraid of being interesting. A sermon does not have to be dry to be spiritual. To the unchurched, dull preaching is unforgivable. Truth, poorly delivered, is ignored. On the other hand, the unchurched will listen to absolute foolishness if it is interesting. To prove this, just turn on your television late at night and you'll see the assortment of psychics, wackos, and weirdos that dominate the airwaves. I mentioned in the last chapter that I am amazed at how some Bible teachers are able to take the most exciting book in the world and bore people to tears with it. I believe it is a sin to bore people with the Bible. When God's Word is taught in an uninteresting way, people don't just think the pastor is boring, they think God is boring. We slander God's character if we preach with an uninspiring style or tone. The message is too important to share it with a take-it-or-leave-it attitude. Jesus captured the interest of large crowds with techniques that you and I can use. First, he told stories to make a point. Jesus was a master storyteller. He would say, "Hey, did you hear the one about..." and then tell a parable in order to teach a truth. In fact, the Bible shows that storytelling was Jesus' favorite technique when speaking to the crowd. Jesus spoke all these things to the crowd in parables. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. Matthew 13:34. Somehow, preachers forget that the Bible is essentially a book of stories. That is how God has chosen to communicate His Word to human beings. There are many benefits to using stories to communicate spiritual truth. Stories hold our attention. The reason television is so popular is because it is essentially a storytelling device. Comedies, dramas, the news, talk shows, even commercials are stories. Stories stir our emotions. They impact us in ways that precepts and propositions never do. If you want to change lives, you must craft the message for impact, not for information. Stories help us remember. Long after a pastor's clever outline is forgotten, people will remember the stories from the sermon. It is fascinating, and sometimes comical, to watch how quickly a crowd tunes in when a speaker begins telling a story, and how quickly their attention vanishes as soon as the story is finished. Second, Jesus used simple language, not technical or theological jargon. He spoke in terms that normal people could understand. We need to remember that Jesus did not use the classical Greek language of the scholar. He spoke in Aramaic, the street language of that day. He talked of birds, flowers, lost coins, and other everyday objects that anyone could relate to. While Jesus taught profound truths in simple ways, many pastors do the exact opposite. They teach simple truths in profound ways. They take straightforward texts and make them complicated. They think they're being deep, when actually they're just being muddy. It is more important to be clear than clever in teaching and preaching. Some pastors like to show off their knowledge by using Greek words and academic terms in their preaching. Every Sunday they speak in an unknown tongue without being charismatic. Pastors need to realize that no one cares as much about the Greek as they do. Chuck Swindoll once told me that he believes an overuse of Greek and Hebrew word studies in preaching discourages confidence in the English text. I agree. Jack Hayford, Chuck Smith, Chuck Swindoll, and I once taught a seminary doctoral course on how we each prepare and deliver sermons. At the end of the course, the students mentioned that all four of us had, without collaboration, emphasized the same thing: keep it simple. It's easy to complicate the gospel, and, of course, Satan would love for us to do just that. The Apostle Paul worried that your minds would be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ. 2 Corinthians 11:3. It takes a lot of thought and preparation to communicate profound truths in simple ways. Einstein once said, "You don't really understand something unless you can communicate it in a simple way. You can be brilliant, but if you can't share your thoughts in a simple way, your insights aren't worth much." The Saddleback Valley is one of the most highly educated communities in America, yet I find that the simpler I make the message, the more God blesses it. Simple does not mean shallow or simplistic. It means being clear and understandable. For instance, "This is the day the Lord has made" is simple, while "Have a nice day" is simplistic. Simple sermon outlines are always the strongest outlines. I consider it a compliment to be called a simple preacher. I'm interested in seeing lives change, not impressing people with my vocabulary. Most people communicate with a vocabulary of less than 2,000 words and rely on only about 900 words in daily use. If you want to communicate with most people, you need to keep it simple. Never allow yourself to be intimidated by people who think they are intellectuals. It's been my observation that people who have to use big words are sometimes hiding bigger insecurities. Ministry to crowds is controversial. I realize that there are some Christians who will disagree with the thesis of this chapter. The controversy over attracting a crowd boils down to two issues. The first has to do with the legitimacy of what is called attraction evangelism, and the other has to do with how the church should relate to the culture it seeks to evangelize. Go and tell, or come and see. Some church leaders deny that attraction is a legitimate method of evangelism. I've heard preachers say, "The Bible does not tell the world to come to church. It tells the church to go to the world." This is an inaccurate statement because it is only half true. Of course, the Bible commands Christians to go and tell. That's what the Great Commission is all about. Christians are not to wait for the world to come and ask us about Christ. We are to take the initiative in sharing the good news. To believers, Jesus says, "Go." But to the lost world, Jesus says, "Come." When a couple of inquirers wanted to know about Jesus, he replied, "Come and you will see." John 1:39. In Matthew 11:28, Jesus said to seekers, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." And on the last day of the great feast, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." John 7:37. Both "go and tell" and "come and see" are found in the New Testament. In Luke 14, where Jesus compared the kingdom of God to a great banquet, the master's servants are to go out and invite the hungry to come in and eat, so that my house may be full. We do not need to choose between go and come. Both are valid forms of evangelism. Some people will be reached by attraction, while others will be reached by confrontation. A balanced, healthy church should provide opportunities and programs for both. At Saddleback, we use both approaches. We say, "Come and see," to our community, but to our core, we say, "Go and tell." Responding to culture, imitation, isolation, or infiltration? Another ongoing debate that affects evangelism has to do with how the church should respond to culture. There are two extreme positions, imitation and isolation. Those in the imitation camp argue that the church must become just like our culture in order to minister to it. Churches in this group sacrifice the biblical message and mission of the church in order to blend in with the culture. They are likely to endorse current cultural values such as the worship of success and wealth, radical individualism, radical feminism, liberal sexual standards, and even homosexuality. In their attempt to be relevant, these churches sacrifice biblical theology, doctrinal distinctiveness, and the gospel of Christ. The call for repentance and commitment is compromised in order to attract a crowd. Syncretism destroys this kind of church. At the other extreme is the isolation camp. This group insists we must avoid any adaptation to culture in order to preserve the purity of the church. They fail to see the distinction between the sinful values of our culture and the non-sinful customs, styles, and preferences that each generation develops. They reject new translations of Scripture, current musical styles, and any attempt to modify man-made traditions, such as the time and order of the worship service that they are accustomed to. Isolationists sometimes have a dress code and a list of what is permissible and what isn't regarding issues that the Bible is silent on. It is human nature to erect theological walls to defend personal preferences. Churches in this group confuse their cultural traditions with orthodoxy. They do not realize that the customs, styles, and methods they feel comfortable with were undoubtedly labeled as modern, worldly, and heretical by a previous generation of believers. Must we choose between liberalism and legalism? Is there a third alternative to imitation and isolation? I'm convinced there is. The strategy of Jesus is the antidote to both extremes. Infiltration. Just as saltwater fish exist their entire lives in an ocean without becoming saturated with salt, Jesus ministered in the world without being of the world. He made his dwelling among us, John 1:14, and was even tempted in every way we are, yet was without sin, Hebrews 4:15. He walked among people, spoke their language, observed their customs, sang their songs, attended their parties, and used their current events, see Luke 13:1-5, to capture attention when he taught. But he did all these things without compromising his mission. Jesus' sinner-sensitive ministry made the religious establishment nervous, and they criticized him ruthlessly. They even attributed his ministry to Satan, Mark 3:22. The Pharisees especially hated the way Jesus made unbelievers feel comfortable in his presence and the way he placed sinners' needs above religious traditions. They scorned Jesus' reputation as a friend of tax collectors and sinners. To them, such a title was the ultimate put-down. But Jesus wore it as a badge of honor. His response was, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Mark 2:17. In Jesus' day, the Pharisees used the excuse of purity to avoid all contact with unbelievers. We still have Pharisees in the church today who are more concerned about purity than people. If your church is serious about the Great Commission, you will never have a completely pure church because you will always be attracting unbelievers with their questionable lifestyles to your crowd services. Evangelism is sometimes messy. Even after people become believers, you still have to deal with their immaturity and carnality, so there will never be a completely pure church. Are there unrepentant pagans mixed into Saddleback's crowd of 10,000? Without a doubt. When you fish with a big net, you catch all kinds of fish. That's okay. Jesus said in one parable, "Don't worry about the tares mixed in among the wheat. One day I'll separate them." See Matthew 13:29-30. We are to leave the weeding to Jesus because he knows who the real tares are. Jesus reserved his most severe words for the rigid religious traditionalists. When the Pharisees asked, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders?" Jesus replied, "Why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition?" Matthew 15:2-3. Fulfilling God's purpose must always take priority over preserving tradition. If you are serious about ministering to people the way Jesus did, don't be surprised if some of today's religious establishment accuse you of selling out to culture and breaking traditions. You will be criticized. Sadly, some isolationists have been extremely judgmental of seeker-sensitive churches in books and articles. Most of these criticisms are unfair characterizations made out of ignorance and do not represent what actually happens in seeker-sensitive churches. Trailblazers always get arrows shot at them. Translating the truth into contemporary terms is dangerous business. Remember, they burned Wycliffe at the stake for doing it. But criticism by other Christians should never keep you from ministering the way Christ did. Jesus should be our ultimate model for ministry, not anyone else. Worship can be a witness. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. John 4:24. This weekend, millions of people will attend an evangelical worship service. The amazing thing is that most of those people could not articulate the purpose of the service they attend if they were asked. They might have a vague idea, but it would be difficult for them to put it into words. In chapters 14 to 16, I will explain how we've designed a service format that has reached thousands of unbelievers for Christ. But first, I feel it is necessary to clarify the theological and practical reasons behind Saddleback's seeker service. Everything that we do in our weekend services is based on 12 deeply held convictions. 12 convictions about worship. 1. Only believers can truly worship God. The direction of worship is from believers to God. We magnify God's name in worship by expressing our love and commitment to Him. Unbelievers simply cannot do this. At Saddleback, our definition of worship is, worship is expressing our love to God for who He is, what He said, and what He's doing. We believe there are many appropriate ways to express our love to God. These include praying, singing, thanking, listening, giving, testifying, trusting, obeying His word, among many others. God, not man, is the focus and center of our worship. 2. You don't need a building to worship God. Acts 17:24 says, "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands." You'd probably expect this emphasis from a church that existed 15 years and grew to over 10,000 in attendance without a building. I think we made our point. Unfortunately, many churches are obsessed with the edifice complex. No building, or lack of one, should ever be allowed to control, limit, or distract people from worshiping God. There's nothing wrong with buildings, unless you worship them instead of the Creator. Jesus said, "For where two or three come together in My name, there am I with them." Matthew 18:20. 3. There is no correct style of worship. Jesus only gave two requirements for legitimate worship. God is spirit, and His worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. John 4:24. I don't think God is offended or even bothered by different styles of worship as long as it is done in spirit and in truth. In fact, I'm certain that God enjoys the variety. Remember, it was His idea to make us all different. The style of worship that you feel comfortable with says far more about your cultural background than it does about your theology. Debates over worship styles are almost always sociological, and personality debates couched in theological terms. Every church likes to believe its worship style is the most biblical. The truth is, there isn't a biblical style of worship. Each Sunday, true believers around the world give glory to Jesus Christ using 1,000 equally valid expressions and styles. Regardless of style, true worship employs both your right brain and your left brain. It engages both emotion and intellect, your heart and your mind. We must worship in spirit and in truth. 4. Unbelievers can watch believers worship. Unbelievers can observe the joy that we feel. They can see how we value God's Word, how we respond to it, and how the Bible answers the problems and questions of life. They can notice how worship encourages, strengthens, and changes us. It is even possible for them to sense when God is supernaturally moving in a service, although they won't be able to explain it. 5. Worship is a powerful witness to unbelievers if God's presence is felt and if the message is understandable. In Acts 2, on the day of Pentecost, God's presence was so evident in the disciples' worship service that it attracted the attention of unbelievers throughout the entire city. Acts 2:6 says, "A crowd came together." We know it must have been a big crowd because 3,000 people were saved that day. Why were those 3,000 people converted? Because they felt God's presence and they understood the message. Both of these elements are essential in order for worship to be a witness. First, God's presence must be sensed in the service. More people are won to Christ by feeling God's presence than by all of our apologetic arguments combined. Few people, if any, are converted to Christ on purely intellectual grounds. It is the sense of God's presence that melts hearts and explodes mental barriers. At the same time, the worship and the message need to be understandable. At Pentecost, the Holy Spirit miraculously translated the message into words each person understood. The crowd of unbelievers said, We hear them telling in our own languages about the great things God has done, Acts 2:11. This ability to understand caused them to be converted. Even though God's presence was evident in the service, they wouldn't have known what to do if they hadn't been able to understand the message. There is an intimate connection between worship and evangelism. It is the goal of evangelism to produce worshipers of God. The Bible tells us that the Father seeks worshipers, John 4:23. So evangelism is the task of recruiting worshipers of God. At the same time, it is worship that provides the motivation for evangelism. It produces a desire in us to tell others about Christ. The result of Isaiah's powerful worship experience, Isaiah 6, 1-8, was Isaiah saying, "Here I am, send me." True worship causes us to witness. In genuine worship, God's presence is felt. God's pardon is offered, God's purposes are revealed, and God's power is displayed. That sounds to me like an ideal context for evangelism. I've noticed that when unbelievers watch believers relate to God in an intelligent, sincere manner, it creates a desire in them to know God too. 6. God expects us to be sensitive to the fears, hang-ups, and needs of unbelievers when they are present in our worship services. This is the principle Paul taught in 1 Corinthians 14. In verse 23, Paul commanded that tongues be limited in public worship. His reasoning? Speaking in tongues seems like foolishness to unbelievers. Paul didn't say tongues were foolish, only that they appear foolish to unbelievers. So if the whole church comes together and everyone speaks in tongues, and some who do not understand or some unbelievers come in, will they not say that you are out of your mind? 1 Corinthians 14:23. I believe there is a larger principle behind this advice to the Corinthian church. The point Paul is making is that we must be willing to adjust our worship practices when unbelievers are present. God tells us to be sensitive to the hang-ups of unbelievers in our services. Being seeker-sensitive in our worship is a biblical command. Although Paul never used the term seeker-sensitive, he definitely pioneered the idea. He was very concerned about not placing any stumbling blocks in front of unbelievers. He told the Corinthian church, "Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God," 1 Corinthians 10:32. He also advised the church at Colossae, "Be tactful with those who are not Christians, and be sure you make the best use of your time with them," Colossians 4:5. When you have guests over to your home for dinner, does your family act differently than when it's just your family at the table? Of course they do. You pay attention to your guests' needs, making sure they're served first. The food may be the same, but you may use a different set of china or present the meal in a more thoughtful way. The table conversation is usually more courteous. Is this being hypocritical? No. By doing these things, you are being sensitive and showing respect to your guests. In the same way, the spiritual food is unchanged in a seeker-sensitive service, but the presentation is more thoughtful and considerate of the guests present. 7. A worship service does not have to be shallow to be seeker-sensitive. The message doesn't have to be compromised, just understandable. Making a service comfortable for the unchurched doesn't mean changing your theology. It means changing the environment of the service. Changing the environment can be done through the way you greet visitors, the style of music you use, the Bible translation you preach from, and the kinds of announcements you make in the service. The message is not always comfortable. In fact, sometimes God's truth is very uncomfortable. Still, we must teach the whole counsel of God. Being seeker-sensitive does not limit what you say, but it does affect how you say it. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, the unchurched are not asking for a watered-down message. They expect to hear the Bible when they come to church. What they do want is to hear how the Bible relates to their lives in terms they understand and in a tone that shows you respect and care about them. They are looking for solutions, not a scolding. Unbelievers wrestle with the same deep questions believers have. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Does life make sense? Why is there suffering and evil in the world? What is my purpose in life? How can I learn to get along with people? These are certainly not shallow issues. 8. The needs of believers and unbelievers often overlap. They are very different in some areas, but are very similar in many areas. Seeker-sensitive services focus on needs common to both believers and unbelievers. For instance, Both believers and unbelievers need to know what God is really like. Both need to understand the purpose of life. Both need to know why and how to forgive others. Both need help in strengthening their marriage and family. Both need to know how to deal with suffering, grief, and pain. Both need to know why materialism is so destructive. Christians do not stop having needs once they are saved. 9. It is best to specialize your services according to their purpose. Most churches try to evangelize the lost and edify believers in the same service. When you send mixed signals, you're going to get mixed results. Trying to aim at two targets with one gun only results in frustration. Design one worship service to edify believers and another service to evangelize the unchurched friends brought by your members. At Saddleback, our believers' service is on Wednesday night, and our seeker services are on Saturday night and Sunday morning. This way you can use different preaching styles, songs, prayers, and other elements appropriate to each target. When I started Saddleback, I asked unchurched people when they would be most likely to visit a church. Every single one said, "If I ever did, it would be a Sunday morning." I also asked our members when they were most likely to bring unchurched friends. Again, they said Sunday morning. Even in today's culture, people still think of Sunday morning as the time you go to church. So that's why we decided to use Sunday morning for evangelism and Wednesday night for edification. Evangelistic services are nothing new. Only the idea of using the Sunday morning time slot for an evangelistic service is a recent variation. Earlier in this century, Sunday evenings were generally recognized as the evangelistic service of churches. A few churches still advertise a Sunday evening evangelistic service, although it's doubtful that many unbelievers show up. Even believers don't like to attend Sunday evenings. They've been voting with their feet on that issue for decades. 10. A service geared toward seekers is meant to supplement personal evangelism, not replace it. People generally find it easier to decide for Christ when there are multiple relationships supporting that decision. Seeker services provide a group witness to enhance and confirm the personal witness of members. When an unbeliever attends a seeker service with a friend who has been witnessing to him, he sees the crowd and thinks, "Hey, there are a lot of other people who believe this. There must be something to it." There is incredible persuasive power in the witness of a crowd of believers worshiping together. For this reason, the larger your seeker service grows, the greater an evangelistic tool it will become. 11. There is no standard way to design a seeker service. This is because unbelievers are not all alike. Some want a service that makes them feel a part of it. Others want to sit passively and watch. Some like quiet, meditative services. Others like high-energy services. The style that works best in Southern California probably won't work in New England and vice versa. It takes all kinds of services to reach all kinds of seekers. There are only three non-negotiable elements of a seeker service. 1. Treat unbelievers with love and respect. 2. Relate the service to their needs. And 3. Share the message in a practical, understandable manner. All other elements are secondary issues that churches shouldn't get hung up on. I first began offering churches suggestions for creating seeker services nearly 20 years ago. Now that this type of service has received a lot of media attention, I sometimes find people overemphasizing minor factors. They worry about getting rid of the pulpit, not wearing a robe, or whether or not to have a drama each week, as if these things will automatically bring the unchurched flocking to their church. They are wrong. If all seekers were looking for was a quality production, they'd stay home and watch TV, where millions are spent to produce half-hour programs. What really attracts large numbers of unchurched to a church is changed lives, a lot of changed lives. People want to go where lives are being changed, where hurts are being healed, and where hope is being restored. At Saddleback, you see changed lives everywhere. In almost every seeker service, we include a real-life testimony from a person or couple who've been dramatically changed by the power and love of Christ. This weekly parade of satisfied customers is hard for skeptics to argue with. Saddleback Church has confounded much of the conventional wisdom about seeker-sensitive churches by winning thousands of unchurched people to Christ in spite of the most unlikely and difficult circumstances. Imagine a church where the location keeps changing, where the unchurched will come and sit in a tent that is freezing in the winter damp and leaky in the rainy spring, blisteringly hot in summer, and has howling winds rip through it in the fall. Imagine a church where people will park 3 miles away when necessary and stand outside under umbrellas in the rain in order to attend. When lives are being changed, problems that otherwise might seem overwhelming to a church are treated as mere nuisances. At every Saddleback service, we invite people to fill out a registration card and sing worship songs. We take an offering, provide a message outline with Bible verses written out on it, and offer a time of commitment. Although I've heard some people claim that you can't reach the unchurched if you do these things, over 7,000 unbelievers have registered a personal commitment to Christ at Saddleback, and thousands of others are considering that decision as they return week after week. It's how you do these things that makes the difference. New approaches and technologies are only tools. You don't have to use drama and multimedia or have a nice building and convenient parking to reach unbelievers. These items just make it easier. Please realize that the suggestions I give in the next 2 chapters are only general guidelines, suggestions from what has worked at Saddleback. Do not treat them like the 10 commandments. Even I wouldn't do everything we do at Saddleback if I were in another part of the country. You must figure out what works best to reach seekers in your local context. 12. It takes unselfish, mature believers to offer a seeker-sensitive service. In 1 Corinthians 14:19 and 20, Paul says that when we think only of our own needs in worship, we are being childish and immature. Members demonstrate incredible spiritual maturity when they're considerate of the needs, fears, and hang-ups of unbelievers and are willing to place those needs before their own in a service. In every church, there is constant tension between the concepts of service and serve us. Most churches end up tipping the scales toward meeting members' needs because the members pay the bills. Offering a seeker service means intentionally tipping the scales in the opposite direction toward unbelievers. It requires members who are willing to create a safe environment for unbelievers at the expense of their own preferences, traditions, and comfort. Enormous spiritual maturity is required to voluntarily move out of a comfort zone. Jesus said, "Your attitude must be like my own, for I, the Messiah, did not come to be served, but to serve." Matthew 20:28. Until this attitude of unselfish servanthood permeates the minds and hearts of your members, your church is not ready to begin a seeker-sensitive service. Designing a seeker-sensitive service. If, therefore, the whole church comes together and all speak in tongues, and outsiders or unbelievers enter, will they not say that you are out of your mind? 1 Corinthians 14:23. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Colossians 4:5. Growing up in a Christian home, I was often frustrated when I brought non-believing friends to church. It seemed inevitable that whenever I'd get one of my friends to attend a service with me, that would be the Sunday my father would preach on tithing. Some guest missionary would show slides, or we'd have a communion service. Not what my unsaved friends needed to hear or experience. Yet it often seemed that on the weekends when I didn't bring lost friends to church, the message would be on the plan of salvation. I'd think, "Boy, I wish my friends were here today." From week to week, I didn't know if the service would be a safe service to which I could bring unbelievers. The focus of the message was always unpredictable, alternating between evangelism and edification. I noticed this same pattern in the churches I attended while in college. Eventually, I gave up inviting non-believers to church. It wasn't a conscious decision. I just got tired of getting burned. Most churches rarely attract unbelievers to their services because members are uncomfortable bringing them to church. It doesn't matter how much the pastor encourages members to bring friends or how many visitation programs are launched. The results are the same. Most members never bring any lost friends to church. Why is this? There are 3 important reasons. First, as I mentioned, the target of the message is unpredictable. Members don't know from week to week if the pastor will be preaching an evangelistic message or an edification message. Second, the services are not designed for unbelievers. So much of what goes on in them would not be understandable to an unchurched friend. Third, members may be embarrassed by the quality of the service. If you were able to get the typical church member to be completely honest about his church, he'd probably say this: "I love my church. I love my pastor. I am personally blessed by what takes place in our services. It meets my needs. But I wouldn't think of inviting my unchurched friends from the office because the service wouldn't make any sense to them. The messages are for me. The songs are for me. The prayers are prayed in terms I understand, and even the announcements are for me. My friends wouldn't understand much of our service." Ironically, at the same time, he may feel guilty for not inviting his friends. Increasing the size of your church does not require the intelligence of a rocket scientist. You must simply get more people to visit. No one becomes a church member without first being a visitor. If you only have a few visitors each year, you'll have even fewer new members. A crowd is not a church, but to grow a larger church, you must first attract a crowd. What is the most natural way to increase the number of visitors to your church? By making members feel guilty for not inviting friends? No. By putting up a big sign that says, "Visitors welcome"? No. By cold calling on homes in your community? Probably not. By holding attendance contests? Unlikely. By using telemarketing or advertising? Wrong again. The answer is quite simple. Create a service that is intentionally designed for your members to bring their friends to. And make the service so attractive, appealing, and relevant to the unchurched that your members are eager to share it with the lost people they care about. Saddleback has offered that kind of service from its beginning. As other churches began to develop similar approaches, the term seeker-sensitive service began to be used to describe this type of service. By creating a service that Christians want to bring their unsaved friends to, you don't have to use contests, campaigns, or guilt to increase attendance. Members will invite their friends week after week, and your church will experience a steady influx of unchurched visitors. In this chapter and the next one, I would like to give you a number of practical suggestions for designing a seeker-sensitive service. Plan the service with your target in mind. Each week at Saddleback, we remind ourselves who we're trying to reach. Saddleback Sam and his wife Samantha. Once you know your target, it will determine many of the components of your seeker service: music style, message topics, testimonies, creative arts, and much more. Most evangelical churches conclude their worship service with an altar call. This indicates that, functionally, we connect worship with evangelism. But many do not realize that it is a self-defeating strategy to focus the first 58 minutes of the service on believers and suddenly switch the focus to unbelievers in the last 2 minutes. Unbelievers are not going to sit through 58 minutes of a service that isn't in the slightest way relevant to them. The entire service, not just the invitation, must be planned with the unchurched in mind. Make it as easy as possible to attend. Americans are conditioned to expect things to be convenient. Your goal should be to remove as many barriers as possible so that the unchurched have no excuse for not attending. Offer multiple service times. This gives people more than one opportunity to attend. Saddleback has offered 4 identical services each weekend for years: Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 8, 9:30, and 11:15 a.m. We've often had unbelievers visit a service, go home, and call a friend, and bring them back to another service because of the sermon topic. Offer surplus parking. In America, it takes parking to reach people. One of the first things visitors notice is parking and traffic control. I once asked several pastors of the largest churches in California what their biggest mistake was in building. Every one of them had the same answer: not enough parking. When people come to church, they like to bring their cars. If you don't have a place for their car, you don't have a place for them. No matter how big your building is, you won't be able to fill it if there isn't enough parking. Offer children's Sunday school simultaneously with the service. Unchurched people don't want to deal with squirming children, either theirs or someone else's. Saddleback offers 4 Sunday schools at the same time as our seeker services. Put a map to your church on all advertising. Nothing is more frustrating than trying to find a place without a map. Saddleback has its own four-lane, half-mile entrance into our property. It's called Saddleback Parkway, and the church is the only address on it. Yet people still get lost trying to find us. Improve the pace and flow of the service. Almost all churches need to pick up the pace of their services. Television has permanently shortened the attention span of Americans. In one timeout during Monday Night Football, you'll see a replay, three commercials, and a network news brief. They don't want you to get bored. MTV has shortened the attention span of baby busters even more. In one three-minute video alone, you may be bombarded with several thousand images. In contrast, most church services move at a snail's pace. There is a lot of dead time between different elements. When the minister of music finishes a song, he walks over and sits down. 15 seconds later, the pastor thinks about getting up. Finally, he slowly moves to the pulpit and welcomes the people. By this time, the unbelievers have already fallen asleep. Work on minimizing transitional times. As soon as one element ends, another should begin. Look for ways to save time in your service. We regularly time each element of our service, the prayers, the songs, the announcements, the message, the closing, and the transitions in between each element. Then we ask ourselves, what took too much time, and what needed more time? Our services usually last about 70 minutes. You can accomplish a lot in that time if you plan it wisely. For instance, your offering time can be cut in half simply by doubling the number of ushers and baskets. Keep your pastoral prayers short in your seeker services. It is not the time to intercede for Sister Bertha's ingrown toenail. The unchurched can't handle long prayers. Their minds wander or they fall asleep. Pastors should be wary of using the pastoral prayer to catch up on their quiet time. In addition to speeding up your service, work on improving its flow. The difference between an average service and an outstanding service is flow. At Saddleback, we use the word IMPACT as an acronym to remind us of the flow we desire to create with our music. Inspire movement. This is what we want to do with the opening song. We use a bright, upbeat number that makes you want to tap your foot, clap, or at least smile. We want to loosen up the tense muscles of uptight visitors. When your body is relaxed, your attitude is less defensive. To begin our service, we wake up the body of Christ by waking up our own bodies. When people enter a morning service, they usually feel stiff, sleepy, and reserved. After our Inspire Movement opening song, the atmosphere always changes to being more cheerful and alert. The difference this opening song makes is absolutely amazing. Praise. We then move to joyful songs about God. Adoration. We move to a more meditative, intimate song to God. The pace is slowed here. Commitment. This song gives people an opportunity to affirm or reaffirm a commitment to God. It is usually a first-person singular song like, "I want to be more like you." Tie it all together. The very last thing we do is end the service on another short, upbeat song. Make visitors feel comfortable. Visitors have already formed an opinion about your church within the first 10 minutes after they arrive. As I mentioned in Chapter 12, visitors are deciding whether or not to come back long before the pastor speaks. First impressions are very difficult to change, so you need to think through what first impressions you want visitors to have. As the old saying goes, you never have a second chance to make a first impression. In dealing with visitors, it is important to understand that their first emotional response is one of fear. If they are genuinely unchurched people, they are wondering, "What is going to happen to me here?" They have the same feelings and fears you'd have if you were invited to a Muslim mosque for the first time. Are they going to lock the doors? Will I have to say something? Will I be embarrassed by anything? Because visitors are filled with apprehension and anxiety, your first objective with them should be to make sure they're relaxed. Communication is blocked when a person is afraid. If you can reduce visitors' level of fear, they'll be far more receptive to the gospel. There are many practical ways to do this. Reserve the best parking spots for visitors. A sign as you enter Saddleback's property asks first-time visitors to turn on their headlights if they'd like the reserved parking closest to the worship center. If you have reserved parking for visitors, you can station greeters there who can welcome visitors with a smile and offer them directions as soon as they get out of their cars. At Saddleback, all pastors and staff park on the dirt. Only visitors get preferred parking spots. Station greeters outside your building. We believe that welcoming visitors is so important, we have four different kinds of welcome ministers: parking attendants, greeters, hosts, and ushers. Parking attendants direct the traffic. These are the first smiles visitors will encounter. Greeters stand in our parking lots and patio areas, casually greeting people as they approach the building. Hosts are stationed at our information tables. Instead of giving directions to newcomers, they personally escort people to where they need to go. Ushers greet people inside the service, pass out programs, assist in special situations, and receive the offering. The most important people in any organization are those who have direct contact with the customer. At Delta Airlines, the most important people to me are the ticket agent and the flight attendant. Delta's president is unimportant to me. Why? I'll never have any contact with him. In your church, your welcome ministers are the most important people to visitors because they make contact in that crucial first 10 minutes. Be sure to use people who project personal warmth and smile easily. It is also important to select greeters and ushers who match your target. If you want to reach young couples, use young couples. If you want to reach teenagers, use teenagers. If you want to reach retirees, use retirees. In many churches, the greeters are the oldest members. If all the people a visitor meets in the first 10 minutes are 40 years older than he is, he'll start wondering if he fits in your church. One last point. Don't identify outside greeters with badges. Greeters with badges make visitors feel they're being welcomed by officials of the church. One of our pastors incorrectly told a group, "We just put our greeters out there with nothing on them." Tell the greeters to simply be themselves, friendly members. Set up information tables outside your buildings. It's fine for the people manning these tables to wear badges because you want visitors to know where to go to ask questions. Place directional signs everywhere. Clearly identify the main entrances to your building, the nursery, and especially the bathrooms. Visitors should not have to ask where the bathrooms are. Have taped music playing when people enter your buildings. Most public buildings have music playing in the background. You can hear it in retail and grocery stores, doctor's offices, professional buildings, and some elevators. They even play music on many airplanes as they sit on the runway. Why? Because music relaxes people. Silence is scary to unchurched visitors. If you were to walk into a large room filled with 200 people and no one was talking, wouldn't you wonder what was going on? You'd think, "What do they know that I don't?" But if you walked into a room where everyone was talking to each other, you would not feel self-conscious at all. There is a place for silence in worship, but it is not at the beginning of a seeker service. Have you ever seen a sign over a church auditorium that says, "Enter in silence"? That is the last thing you want in a seeker service. You want the atmosphere before the service starts to be alive and happy and contagious with joy. We've noticed an interesting phenomenon. The louder you play background music, the more animatedly people talk. If you play quiet music, people talk softly. When visitors walk into a building where people are talking normally to each other and upbeat music is playing, it eases their fears. They notice that people are enjoying each other and are happy to be there. They notice that there is life in the church. Allow visitors to remain anonymous in the service. Once visitors are seated, we don't bother them or single them out. We allow them to watch the service without publicly identifying themselves. We want them to feel welcomed and wanted without feeling watched. Ironically, the way many churches welcome visitors actually makes them feel more uncomfortable than if they'd just been left alone. Visitors hate to be singled out for public recognition. The one exception to this is visiting denominational officials. One reason large churches attract so many visitors is because newcomers like being able to hide in a crowd. In a small church, everyone knows who the visitor is, and the visitor knows they know. In America, the most common fear people have is going to a party where they will be surrounded by strangers. The second most common fear is having to speak before a crowd, and the third most common fear is being asked a personal question in public. The way many churches welcome visitors causes them to experience their three greatest fears all at once. The pastor, thinking he's being friendly, will say, "Please stand up. Tell us your name and a little about yourself." We don't realize that when we do this, the visitor is dying a thousand deaths in his mind. When I lived in Fort Worth, Kay and I belonged to a church that decided it would be better to reverse the process. So instead of having visitors stand and introduce themselves, all of the members were asked to stand each week while the visitors remained seated. Then the members were expected to turn to the seated visitors and sing a welcome song to them. Can you imagine this? The first time we visited, the members stood up all around us, and all I could see was a bunch of big fat fannies. Then they began to sing to us, "We're so glad to have you here. It's so great to have you near." I wanted to die on the spot. Have you ever been sung to by a stranger? I get embarrassed if my wife sings to me. The moral to the story? Think through everything you do from a visitor's viewpoint. Even though I refer to newcomers as visitors, we don't call them that at Saddleback. We call them guests. The term visitor implies they're not here to stay. The term guest implies that this is someone for whom you do everything you can to make feel comfortable. If you use a registration card, have everyone fill one out. When everyone registers, visitors aren't singled out. They see that this is something that everybody does. Saddleback's welcome card is a vital communication tool. We use it in at least a dozen different ways: to register attendance, record spiritual decisions, gather prayer requests, take surveys, sign up for events and programs, recruit leadership, evaluate services, update membership information, gather sermon ideas, and start new ministries, among many others. It is a vital link that allows me to keep my finger on the pulse of our growing church. These cards are worth their weight in gold. I used to read every single card every week. They helped me memorize all the names of people until we reached 3,000 in attendance. Now I only read the cards with notes that are specifically addressed to me, but it is still a direct link to me. Everyone knows that anyone can get a message to me via the welcome card. I've found that people will tell you things in writing that they'd never say to you otherwise. On the card, there is also a place for visitors to indicate whether it is their first, second, or third visit to our church. In response to each of these, they get a different thank you note from me. I urge you not to use registration books which are passed down the rows for everyone to sign. They violate anonymity. Everyone on that row can see what a visitor has written. Also, the logistics of retrieving names from registration books are more difficult than with cards. Our cards are collected at the same time as the offering. It gives everyone something to put in the offering basket. As soon as the offering is collected, a team of data entry people begins sorting and entering all the information from the cards into computers for use by the staff. Offer a public welcome that relaxes people. The first words from the stage set the tone of the service. Each week, one of our pastors will say something like, "Welcome to Sunday at Saddleback. We're glad you're here. If you're here for the first time, we want you to sit back, relax, and enjoy the service we've planned for you." Let people know they can expect to enjoy the service. Tell them they won't have to say anything, and nobody's going to embarrass them. Offer a disclaimer about the offering. If you're visiting with us, please understand that you're not expected to participate in the offering. This is only for those who are part of our church family. As our guest, we want you to get something out of this service. We don't expect you to give. Begin and end each service with people greeting each other. We are told 5 times in the New Testament to greet one another and show affection. So, at the beginning and the end of each service, we tell everyone to turn around and shake hands with 3 or 10 or 20 people. Over the years, this simple tradition has created a warm sense of camaraderie and family between people who don't even know each other. Sometimes I have people say something to each other at the end of a service like, "It was nice sitting by you today." For some people, this small act of friendliness is the only affirmation they get all week. In the early years of Saddleback, the members practiced what we called the 3-minute rule. We all agreed that for the first 3 minutes after the service was over, members would talk only to people they'd never met. This was based on the fact that the first people to leave after a service are the visitors, so we would wait until after all the visitors had left to fellowship with each other. If you use name tags, make sure everybody gets one. Don't single out visitors by either making them wear one when no one else does, or by not giving them one when everyone else has one. Offer a refreshment table at each service. Visitors hang around longer after a service if you can get a cup of coffee and a donut into their hands. This also gives members a chance to meet them. Eating tends to relax people in social settings. I don't know why it works, but somehow a 300-pound guy feels more secure in an unfamiliar crowd if he has a small styrofoam cup of coffee to hide behind. It has always fascinated me that Jesus did so much of his teaching when people were walking or eating with him. I'm sure this was intentional. Both of those activities relax people and reduce relational barriers. When people are relaxed, they listen better, and they are more open to change. Brighten up the environment. Facilities and physical environment have a lot to do with what happens in a service. The shape of your building will shape your service. Walk into some buildings and your mood will instantly brighten. Walk into others and you feel depressed. Just as the shape of a room can change a mood instantly, so can its temperature and its lighting. Be aware of these factors and use them. Figure out what mood you want your service to project, and then create it. At Saddleback, we summarize the mood we want in our seeker services with the word celebration. Each Sunday is Easter at Saddleback, so we are fanatical about creating a light, bright, cheerful environment. Visitors can sense this the moment they enter the facility. Look at your facilities from the eyes of a visitor and try to determine what message your building is communicating. What is it saying? Does an entrance with heavy, dark wood doors give off a different message than one with glass doors? Of course it does. Even before the service begins, visitors are making value judgments about your church. The moment they get out of their cars in your parking lot, they begin picking up clues by looking at the grounds around your facilities. Does your landscaping appear well kept? Is the grass mowed and are the hedges trimmed? Is there trash lying around? Does the church sign need to be painted? Cleanliness is attractive. Dirty, unkempt grounds and facilities are repulsive. Sometimes the message of the facilities contradicts the message intended by your church. You may be saying we're friendly, but your buildings may be saying we're cold and impersonal. You may claim we're relevant, but your building may be screaming we're 50 years behind the times. It's difficult to project a we've got it all together image if your building is falling apart. One of the problems faced in maintaining the church environment is that you tend to overlook defects after about 4 weeks. Once you become familiar with a building, you stop noticing what's wrong with it. You become oblivious to the faded paint, the frayed carpet, the chipped pulpit, the outdated rack of tracts in the vestibule, the old bulletins left inside hymnals, the stack of music on the piano, the burned-out light bulbs overhead. Unfortunately, these things stand out immediately to visitors who notice details. One way to combat this tendency is to do an environmental impact report on your church. Get a photographer to walk around your facilities and take pictures from the eyes of a visitor. Then show those pictures to your leaders and determine what needs to be changed. Most pastors have never viewed their auditorium while sitting in the back row. Environmental factors that you need to pay close attention to include lighting, sound, seating, space, temperature, plants, nurseries, and restrooms. Lighting. Lighting has a profound effect on people's moods. Inadequate lighting dampens the spirit of a service. Shadows across a speaker's face reduce the impact of any message. Most churches are far too dark. Maybe it's conditioning from all those years Christians spent worshiping in the catacombs. Even churches with plenty of windows often cover them up. Somehow, churches have gotten the idea that dimming the lights creates a more spiritual mood. I completely disagree. I believe that church buildings should be bright and full of light. God's character is expressed in light. 1 John 1:5 says, God is light. In Him there is no darkness at all. Light was the very first thing God created, Genesis 1:3. Today I think God would like to say, let there be light to thousands of churches. If you want to wake up your services, brighten up your environment. Take the curtains off your windows. Throw open the windows and doors. Turn on all the lights. This week, secretly replace all the light bulbs in your worship center with twice the watts. Then, study the change in mood in next Sunday's service. You may have a revival on your hands. Sound. Invest in the best sound system you can afford. If you're trying to cut costs, do it in some other area. Don't skimp here. Saddleback grew for 15 years without our own building, but we've always had a state-of-the-art sound system. It doesn't matter how persuasive the message is if people can't hear it in a pleasing manner. A tinny, fuzzy sound system can undermine the most gifted musician and incapacitate the most profound preacher. And nothing can destroy a holy moment faster than a loud blast of feedback. If you are a pastor, insist that your church purchase a lavalier microphone so you are not handcuffed to the pulpit. Seating. Both the comfort and the arrangement of your seating dramatically affect the mood of any service. The mind can only absorb what the seat can endure. Uncomfortable seating is a distraction that the devil loves to use. If you can get away with replacing the pews, I'd advise it. In today's culture, the only places people are forced to sit on benches are in church and in the cheap bleacher section at ball games. People expect to have their own individual chairs. Personal space is highly valued in our society. This is why box seats are prized at stadiums. If people are forced to sit too close to each other, they get very uncomfortable. There should be at least 18 inches between people if you're using chairs and 21 inches between people if you're using pews. If you use movable seats, set them up so that each person can see someone else's face. It will dramatically improve how people respond to the service. If you are planting a new church, always set up fewer chairs than you need. It's encouraging to your people when additional chairs must be brought in as people arrive. It's very discouraging to worship in a service when surrounded by empty chairs. Space. The one rule about space is this: don't have too much or too little. Either extreme will limit your growth. When your service is 80% filled, you need to start another service. One reason many churches plateau is that they think they don't need to add another service because there are still a few open seats available. When you run out of space, you experience what Pete Wagner calls sociological strangulation. A small building can strangle the growth of a church. You can also have too much space. Many churches have a building far too large for them to fill. Even if you've got 200 people attending, if your auditorium seats 750, it feels like no one is here. It's almost impossible to create a feeling of warmth and intimacy when there are more empty chairs than people. An important growth dynamic is lost when your building is too big for your church. The smaller the crowd, the closer the speaker needs to be to them. As your crowd grows larger, the lectern or pulpit can be moved farther back and raised on a higher stage. If you only have 50 people in a service, put a lectern just a few feet in front of your first row. Forget the stage. Temperature. As a pastor who has preached for years in un-air-conditioned gyms and unheated tents, I say this with the utmost conviction. The temperature can destroy the best planned service in a matter of minutes. When people are too hot or too cold, they stop participating. They mentally check out and start hoping for everything to end quickly. The most common mistake churches make regarding temperature is to allow the building to become too warm. An usher sets the thermostat at a reasonable setting before the service without realizing that when the building is actually filled with a crowd, the body heat will raise the temperature substantially. By the time the air conditioning has cooled everything down, the service is nearly over. Before the service begins, set the thermostat several degrees cooler than what is comfortable. Cool it down before the crowd gets there. The temperature will rise quite quickly once the service starts. Keeping the temperature on the cool side will keep everyone awake. Plants. I encourage you to use plants, trees, and greenery as decorations in your facilities. For years, we hauled plants, ferns, and small trees in and out of rented facilities each weekend. Plants say, at least something is alive in this place. I'm sure you've heard people say, "I feel close to God when I'm out in nature." That's understandable. When God made Adam and Eve, He didn't put them in a skyscraper with concrete and asphalt all around them. He placed them in a garden. The natural beauty of God's creation inspires, relaxes, and restores people. It's no accident that Psalm 23 is the most beloved psalm. People can easily imagine the refreshing scene of still waters and green pastures. As a side note, be careful not to overdo mystical religious symbols in your facilities. Everyone knows what the cross is, but the unchurched are confused by chalices, crowns, and doves with fire coming out of their tails. Clean, safe nurseries. If you want to reach young families, you've got to have sanitized, safe nurseries. There should be no mop buckets in the corners, and the toys should be cleaned each week. Clean restrooms. Visitors may forget the sermon, but the memory of a foul-smelling restroom lingers on. And on. And on. You can tell a lot about the morale of a church by checking out the quality of the restrooms. The sad truth is that many churches need a completely new building. They'll never reach their community in the building they're using. One pastor told me in frustration that he was praying, "God, let the fire fall." When my friend Larry DeWitt was called to pastor a church in Southern California, he found a small, clapboard church building in a high-tech suburban area. Larry recognized that the age and the style of the building were a barrier to reaching that community. He told the church leaders he'd accept the pastorate if they'd move out of the building and start holding services in a Hungry Tiger restaurant. The members agreed. Today, after moving to different facilities, that church has grown to several thousand in attendance. It would have never grown that large if they had stayed in their original building. As I stated in Chapter 1, the shoe must never tell the foot how big it can get. Saddleback used high school campuses for our seeker services for 13 years. In order to make the best of what we had to work with, we organized two quality control crews. The first crew would come in before 6 a.m. and set up 42 different classrooms and a gymnasium. The setup crew would diagram each classroom's layout on the chalkboard before moving anything. That way, everything could be reset in the right order by the takedown crew when they came in at 1 p.m. after all the services were over. Every classroom was vacuumed twice every Sunday, once at the beginning of the day and once after we'd finished using the rooms. It was hard work, but part of the price of growth. The goal in all that we do to brighten up the environment is the same as what Paul said in Titus 2:10, so that in every way they will make the teaching about God, our Savior, attractive. Create an attractive atmosphere. Atmosphere is that hard to define but unmistakable feeling you get when you enter a church service. It's often called the spirit, the mood, or the tone of the service. Regardless of what you call it, atmosphere definitely impacts what happens in your service. It can either work for your purpose or against what you're trying to accomplish. If you don't purposely determine the type of atmosphere you want to create in a service, you are leaving it to chance